Hello, beautiful people. Welcome back to another episode of The Switch. And as usual, my name is Stone Fatayo. Interestingly, we have royalty in our midst today. We'll be speaking with Alan. I hope I got that right this time, because I know it's...
So good if it's Alan. Yes, perfect. Alan, yeah. Hunkins, that's me.
Awesome. So I'll be speaking to Alan today. So Alan has worked with over 2,000 groups of leaders in 25 countries. So that's why I call him royalty anyway. Including Walmart, Pfizer, Citigroup, and he has a book that is a bestseller on Amazon, Cracking the Leadership Code, Secrets to Building Strong Leaders. Alan is also a member of the faculty of the Duke Corporate Education. Some place I've always wanted to, you know, take a program. Hopefully I'll get to do that one of these days. So welcome to the episode. Alan, good to have you here.
Thanks
for honoring our little invite.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Ife.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, so I'm just going to, you know, kick right off and then I'm just going to dive right in. So leadership, right? I know there's no hard and fast rule about leadership, right? But most of the time, one of the things I've noticed, and I've noticed because I'm also trying to write, a PhD in leadership, and one of the areas I'm focusing on is the disconnect between middle management and senior management. You know, I've read some papers and some research, and there seem to be a lot of disconnect there, right? But I've also noticed that you've spoken about disconnect between management and or leadership, and not just, you know, their employees, but also the people that they're serving as well. Case in point, the United States Postal Service story I listened to on TEDx. Why is there so much disconnect, right? Why? And over time, you find out that it just doesn't go away. I'm tempted to say it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Great question, Ife. You know, so this disconnect between kind of leadership, because, you know, I don't think, so for those that haven't heard the story about the United States Postal Service, that basically they did a whole internal survey and discovered that customers of the post office were very unhappy because they were having to wait in line too long to go up to the counter and do their business at the Postal Service. And so after months of planning and writing an 87-page strategic plan, they came up with what they consider their best case solution, which was, okay, we've got a lot of people who are upset about waiting in line for too long. What are we gonna do? We're gonna take all the clocks out of the lobbies of every single post office in the United States. Like, that was their solution. You know, and again, I think people, you know, when I share that story, people laugh, but they also resonate with it, because while it sounds a little far-fetched, I think most of us in our organizations have experienced something where we thought about the leaders, like, what were they thinking? Were they thinking? You know, like, this is such a dumb idea. And I think the disconnect that you asked about comes from the fact that, you know, all of us tend to gravitate towards the things that are our strengths, right? So if I'm good at something, like, you know, like, let's say with exercise, like, let's say I'm a natural swimmer, but I'm a horrible runner. Well, I'm probably going to spend a lot more time in the pool than I am out on the road running. It's just like, I'm going to gravitate towards what I'm strong at already. And so many people who wind up in leadership roles got there because they were very good individual contributors, and we tend to focus more on the numbers side of things, right? The finance, the analytics, the data. And what people who end up, so oftentimes you see many CFOs get promoted to be CEOs, for example.
Sure.
They feel this need to. And thing is, what makes you a strong doer does not make you a strong leader. You know, my colleague Marshall Goldsmith has this wonderful book, which is titled, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And I think one of the disconnects has to do with the fact that so many leaders are strong in things that have not to do with people. And the fact is, you know, we sometimes use the words manager and leader interchangeably, but the fact is you can manage projects, you can manage tasks, but you don't manage people. People need to be led. And that means that you have to have an understanding of psychology and human behavior and motivation, because the work doesn't get done by itself. I mean, so there are so many people who are skilled at reading spreadsheets and looking at like performance reports and key performance indicators and metrics. But the fact is, let's say any metric in any organization, whether that's sales or quality or operations or error rates, all those metrics are only lagging indicators that are behaviors of people, right? Products don't sell themselves. Salespeople sell products, right? Operations, sure. You know, product doesn't fly out on a truck by itself. There are people who are taking those things, whatever, let's say off the manufacturing assembly line, putting them onto a pallet, getting those pallets onto a truck, going logistics. So it's all about people. And so the thing, and I'll tell a story around this too, that kind of brings this to life. And I think, if you think about it, so many people, like I said, they get promoted. And what tends to happen is we tend to copy the behaviors of the leaders that we have seen. And so a lot of us, our first leaders that we know are either our parents or our teachers at school. And there's power there, right? Like when you're 3 years old and you're with a giant, literally a giant, right? Your parents are so much to tower over you. And they're bigger than you, and they also tell you where to go and what to do. You basically follow because you don't have a lot of choice. You're 3, you're 4, you're 5, you're 7 years old, whatever that is. And so what ends up happening is people copy those behaviors when they step into leadership roles. And I'm gonna tell you about a guy I met named Matt. Now, Matt works for a US-based retail franchise, and they happen to have 100 districts. They have about 950 stores all over the United States. And each store is part of a district. And there's 100 districts. And when I met Matt, he's a district manager. And they rank by performance all of the district managers. And it turns out that when I met Matt, he was the number one top-ranked district manager. I said, Matt, that's amazing. Have you always been such a high-performing leader? And he said, no, actually, when I first got promoted to district manager, I was terrible. I was about 84th out of 100, and I stayed down there for a number of years. So I thought, okay, Matt's got a story here. Tell me, Matt, what changed? Because clearly you did something to shift from being 84th to number one. And this is what Matt told me. He said when he started and got promoted as district manager, he said, honestly, he said, I was full of myself. You know, I got promoted. I'm the boss. I'm in charge. It's my job to fix things, tell people what to do. That's what he thought his job was. So every day in their stores, they print out what they call it the hot list. It's a list of their key performance metrics for their retail franchise. And so every single day, Matt would print out for his 9 stores, he would print out the hot list and he'd look for what was in red, right? They had red, yellow, green. You know, red is obviously not measuring up, green is good. So he'd circle what was in red, not measuring up. And then he'd have his list with circled red things next to him in his car, and he would drive from store to store, and he'd get to the store and say, hey, this isn't red. You got to fix this. You got to do this. And he would tell people, fix this, do this. And he'd drive from store to store pretty much all day, telling them what they need to do, and this is what you need to do. And what he found was the numbers were getting worse. They weren't getting better. Everything was getting worse. And he said the worst day, the day that he hit bottom, was the day that he realized there were people in the stores who were quitting, and he didn't even know what their names were. It was this revolving cast of characters, whether that were employees or managers. Like, wow, I've got to change my approach. So he reached out for some mentoring, and what he ended up doing was completely shifting his philosophy and his approach to how he was leading. So what he started doing, he would get the printouts of the hot list every single morning. And he'd take them with him, and he'd go to every store. But instead of starting off and saying, hey, Ife, you got to fix this. You got to do this. He'd say, hey, Ife, hey, happy Monday. How was your weekend? How's your family? What did you do? He'd start to build real relationships with people.
Yeah.
So he'd start with that. And then after building relationships, he'd pull out the hot list, and he'd say, hey, Ife, here's the metrics from last week. What do you think we need to focus on? So instead of leading by telling, he'd lead by listening and asking. And then together, like me and you, let's say I'm him and you're you know, he would go, and then they would co-create solutions together. And so what I found in Matt's story, and what Matt told me, he said when he started doing that, the numbers started to go up. And he said what he realized was the key to making the numbers, to hitting his performance targets, was to stop focusing on the numbers first. It was instead to start focusing on the people, because ultimately it is the people that deliver those numbers. And he said the best part about all this is that he said, I'm now, and our team, we're number one in the company. Our lives are so much less stressful and more enjoyable now than they were when we were 84th. And so what Matt's story really illustrates are what I call the three secrets to be building strong leaders: connection, communication, and collaboration. Number one is connection, right? So it's ultimately about, you have to build human-to-human relationships with real live other human beings. Communication is about working together to listen, to create shared understanding so that you have a platform to make really good decisions to get good results. And then collaboration is around, what can we do as leaders to create an environment where people around us can perform at their best. So anyway, that's the story that brings the connection, communication, and collaboration to life. And I think the disconnect goes back to the fact that you have too many people who don't recognize that the secret sauce in all of it are people.
And it's interesting, right? So I'm going to pick on the second, you know, the second phrase, which is communication. And I think that, especially leaders, one of the things I've noticed is they don't like to listen, right? They just don't want to hear. What exactly, is it an ego problem? Is it an emotional problem? Is it a behavioral problem? What exactly is it that says, look, I'm the boss here, I'm the leader here, you have to do what exactly it is that I do. I'm going to tie that into emotional intelligence. Is it?
Yeah.
In a what sense,
a great question.
Right? Yeah, in a sense,
oh, I
right?
love this question. Yeah, because.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that get in the way. In the book, I kind of dive into this, because I think what's important, you know, as a leader, you don't just need prescriptions to do this. What you need to know is, what are the things that, like your question, what are the things that get in the way? And there's a number of things that keep leaders from listening. One is, again, we said many people who are in leadership roles, they tended to be very high performing individuals. In fact, so high performing, let's say you're in sales, Ife, you're such a good salesperson, we're going to promote you and make you the head of the sales team. Right? It's a totally different skill set. Yeah. But because you've had this strength and you're so good at this individually, let's say someone is struggling to figure out what they should do. You're now trying to coach one of your sales, let's say you're in sales, right? So you're coaching one of your salespeople and they're struggling. Your tendency is, because you want to help, you're like, oh, let me tell you what to do. Just do, and you fall into the advice trap and you like you fill in, like, instead of giving them a little bit of time and space. Look, the only way we learn is by struggling beyond our comfort zone. Because look, to learn something new, it means you haven't done it yet, which means you're not going to be that good at it. So part of it has to do with this desire to rescue. And I think the other thing that feeds, familiar with emotional intelligence and just biological rhythms of people, is it's a dopamine hit, right? It's like, oh, look how important I am. So it feeds the ego, right? So our dopamine hit, like, oh, look how important, I've achieved something. I can, you know, put a little check mark, check the box that I've done these things. So that's one of the things. The other thing is that listening takes patience. And also, and part of the whole thing around ego, I mean, and this came to life for me very much when I had my first child. So I have a son who's now 18. But I remember very much before he was born, I was much more egocentric. I thought the world kind of revolved around me. Frankly, I did. Right? And you have to realize that when you're a leader, it's not about you. And you have to like realize that. So listening means, you know what? I need to take some time and give this person some time to, you know, process through what they're doing, to feel what they're like, understand, to clarify whatever the issues are. And I can't just jump in there, you know. And the thing is, you know, so many leaders say, well, you don't understand, I'm really busy, I don't have time. And I call BS on that, right? Because the fact is, no one gets 36 hours a day. Like, we all have to work with 168 hours a week. That's all anyone gets. So for me, saying that you're busy or I'm too busy is an excuse. What it tells me is, I don't know how to prioritize well. I don't actually focus on the things that are most important. And so I coach leaders like, you can't say I'm too busy. I'll give you an example of this. So one of the trainings that I do, we actually teach leaders how to engage with people. And for this particular training, what we do is, this is for a large organization, thousands of people. So we have top level leaders who kind of top, you know, executives. And we bring in some junior employees that they have never met that are also in the organization. Again, thousands of people, so they haven't met these people. And let's say there's 30 leaders and we bring in 30 junior people. And the exercise is, okay, you have these 30 people, you're gonna meet one of these people, and you are gonna go and have 30 minutes to have coffee with them. And your entire goal is to engage with them. That's it. Okay, that's all I have to do, is engage with them, whatever that means to you. And then after the 30 minutes is up, we take the executives off to one room, we take the junior people off to one room, and we do a little focus group feedback. How did that go? What did the leader do well to engage with you? What could they have done better? And then we take all that feedback, we bring it back to the leaders. So I share all this because many times a lot of leaders have said, you know what? I think because I was intentional over those 30 minutes with this one person, I know that one person now. I know that person better. There are people who have been working for me on my team for 3 years. And I know more about this one person from 30 minutes than I have from working with somebody for 3 years. That isn't a question of time, right? 30 minutes versus 3 years. Obviously, you have more time in 3 years. It's a question of intention. It's a question of what are you doing with the time that you have? So I think all these contribute to the fact that a lot of leaders don't listen. And they are, in fact, look, if you are scattered and you have your mind going in 10 different directions at once, I don't know about you, but I can't listen very well in this. So you've got to really be able to compartmentalize and put things to the side and say, what is right in front of me right now? What is the number one thing I need to focus on? You know, many of us have heard about multitasking. You know, again, if you're going into a meeting with somebody and you're on your computer or on your phone and you're trying to, you're not doing anything well. One of my colleagues calls this continuous partial attention, which is basically just doing everything really poorly. You know, human beings are designed to focus on one thing at a time. And so we need to really take our, and our time and our attention and our presence is the most valuable thing that we have. So I would say those are the things that get in the way of listening well.
So, I mean, you know, while you were speaking, you spoke about something really, really important, and which is a norm, especially in the corporate world, is focusing on the numbers versus focusing on the people, right? And which is pretty much why we promote, you know, people who have, you know, that finance manager who's able to cut costs at barest minimum, or the head of sales who's able to, you know, bring in the numbers, drive up revenue, and all of that stuff, right? I mean, so how, okay, I'm going to ask two questions in this, two layered questions.
Sure.
The first one is, should organizations say, look, yes, we have people who are doing well with the numbers, but how do we balance that as an organization, or should it be individual driven, right? I mean, if I want to become, should we just say, look, this person is doing great, we gave him a target of $1 million, you know, he's hit that figure, and let's just make him head of the unit or head of department, or we have to put him in a program to say, look, this is new territory, right? Yes, you're a good salesman, perfect, right? But you're not a good leader because you haven't really been tested, right, and on the leadership skill. How should it be, you know, should it come for the, from the organization, or should it be individually driven? That's the first question. Second question is, I'm listening to Alan and I'm saying, look, I've been doing, you know, I've been hitting my numbers over, you know, I've been best performer in terms of numbers, I've hit all my figures, but I want to be able to attain a leadership position, right? And I know for sure that if I do that with the skills that I have now, I won't be able to transition from being a core, let me use the word, core technical person or core technocrat to become, you know, a proper leader. How do I transition as an individual to say, look, I've done well as a salesperson or as a CFO, as a, an engineer, but now I need to become a leader?
Yeah. These are really good questions, Tiffy. The first is something to consider, and this is just, I think, within organizations. A lot of times, the only avenue for promotion in an organization is to move out of individual contributor role into a leading people role. And then, you know, with that promotion comes more money, more status, etc. And the challenge, and some organizations are starting to do it differently, is realizing, you know, not everyone is cut out to lead people. So for example, you have some brilliant software engineers, but they're not cut out to be engineering managers of other people. And so some companies, what they're doing now is they're actually creating these kind of niche roles for specialists where they can get promoted, but keep that contributor status instead of moving in. So again, you've got to look at your overall systems, and if what you're rewarding only focuses on this, then people are going to try to get there. So that's one piece of it. I think going back to your earlier, I think the first question had to do with, you know, what can we do if someone is ready? So you know, one of the challenges within organizations is that things like profit, sales, quality metrics, they're much more quantifiable, which is why we call them like hard analytics, as opposed to, you know, what is the impact? Hard skills as opposed to soft skills. Because what is the impact on culture? Harder to quantify in terms of stuff. I mean, there are ways and we're getting better at doing that. But what we do know is, for example, you can have a salesperson who hits their numbers, like let's say that you said the $1 million, blows the targets out of the water, does a great job with that, and yet wreaks havoc on operations because the way in which they make their $1 million, they're basically throwing the rest of the system under the bus. They're not able to really collaborate. You know, they're making promises to customers that create unrealistic timelines. There's massive amounts of pressure. Other people's sales aren't able to get delivered, all sorts of things. So all of which to say is, you know, when I say put the people before the numbers, you know, people tend to go towards binary. So you're saying people are important and numbers are not. No, I'm not saying that at all. It's instead of an either or mindset, it's a both and mindset. And part of what leaders need to do today is embrace paradox. It's like people are important and numbers are important. Yet, what is the priority? Let's prioritize the people first and then get to the numbers. I'll give you another story on this. So if you think about your typical business meeting that many of us have been a part of, whether it's a weekly or a monthly status update, it's the first thing we talk about. All right, let's talk about last month's numbers, right? We talk about the numbers and that takes up most of the meeting. And if there's any time left, we might say, okay, so what are the big projects that are people working on? So we kind of talk about the projects. And if there's any time left after that, we might get to, so what are the people up to? Like in that, but rarely does that ever happen because by then we're out of time, right? We spend too much time already talking through last month's sales, next month's projected sales, etc. So, and there's a wonderful guy named Hubert Joly. He's retired now from this. He was the CEO of Best Buy, a big electronics company.
Yeah.
And what he did, and he's just written a book called The Heart of Business that came out last year. Wonderful book. So what Hubert Joly did was, and again, he's the CEO, so he changed his meeting structure around. And instead of starting with the numbers and then the projects and the people, he flipped it. He said, let's talk about the people first. He said, I can guarantee you, the finance people won't let us leave this meeting without talking about the numbers. But we're not going to prioritize the numbers first. Because like I said before, the numbers are only a lagging indicator of what the people are doing. So let's start talking about that. Because, you know, so many organizations struggle with bench strength, with succession planning, with retention, with how are we going to attract people. Those are the harder conversations to have because they're not, you know, six is always six. Six is always one more than five and one less than seven. It's an easy conversation. And I think a lot of leaders are more comfortable in things that they can really touch and control, like numbers, you know. And again, numbers can be massaged to, you know, make your quarterly earnings, etc. So, so anyway, that's kind of where things play out in terms of that. And I think, you know, a useful strategy for any leader listening right now is, where might I be defaulting to binary either or thinking? And if I was to embrace the paradox here, what would both and solutions look like? You know, so thinking both and instead of either or.
Yeah. I mean, so that goes on to my next question. As an individual in a workplace, to say, look, I'm hitting my numbers, but I need to become a leader. What should I do to be able to, you know, find that balance between, you know, being a salesperson or being a fantastic engineer and then being able to lead?
Well, I think that part of that has to do, like, let's say I'm a fantastic engineer, but I want to move into leadership. I think it's hopefully there are mentors and people is to say, hey, first of all, state your intentions. Like, I would like to move into this. What do I need to do? And what kind of support and coaching can I get to develop and round out these skills that I have not had to really exercise yet? You know, are there ways that, for example, is there a project that I can take a junior role on? Is there something that I can lead without stepping into the overall formal leadership? Like, is there a project that I can lead and get some coaching and feedback on how I'm doing so I can do the next project better? You know, I think there's ideas of if we can build some smaller steps along the way that will help people as they move forward.
Interesting. I mean, so still on the issue of leadership, right? How can I, as leader, say, I'm leading this group of people, 3, 4, 5, 10, 100, how can I build some sort of, try not to make, well, to a large sense, you know, some sort of cultic or loyalty. Yeah, I think that's a better one. Some sort of loyalty within that team to be able to say, look, we're building to basically make everybody want to become part of your team. How can you, you know, put some collaboration, or how do you put some collaboration within your team that, you know, that fosters loyalty?
Yeah, I think there's four things to answer your question. You're like, what are the things that you can do? And this to me comes down to, what am I doing to create an environment where people not just show up, but want to show up, want to do their best work? And that's
exactly,
to me, that's kind of the measure of loyalty, right? It's like, you don't just show up because it's a job. You show up because you want to. You're excited to get out of bed and come to work, you know, if you're coming, or logging on if you're doing it remotely. There's four things, I think. And I think, again, maybe different with 5 people than 100 people, but I think with 100 people, it's the same principle. You may just, hopefully, you're not having 100 people directly report to you. You probably need some more lines, because I think part of it is we have to feel connected. And so the first piece has to do what I call it safety, you know, and I'm sure you're familiar with the idea of psychological safety. And one of the keys to psychological safety is people feel like their voice is heard. So everything around, we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. Inclusion creates a feeling of belonging. So part of safety is people have to feel like, I belong here, that this is my tribe. I belong in this community, and I feel happy to be a part of this community. I feel like I'm seen, I'm valued, I'm recognized. And so part of that is giving people space and time. It means listening to them, not just talking at them, but talking with them and really listening to them. So that's the first piece is safety. Because when people feel unsafe, they start to put up walls and barriers, and trust goes down, and people start spending their free time, or even their work time, you know, going on LinkedIn and wherever else they would go looking for another job somewhere else, because they're going, I don't feel like I belong here. It's not great. So that's the first piece. The next piece has to do with energy. So the fact is, there are certain things that we do as leaders that help fuel energy. There are certain things that we do that drain energy in people. I'll give you a simple example. I'm sure we've all been in meetings that have a lot to do, and let's say we block out 3 hours for this meeting. And whoever's leading the meeting, you know, we were like already 2 hours in, and we still haven't taken a break. And people are starting, you know, their skin is starting to crawl. Like, people have to go to the bathroom, get up, stretch. They're getting antsy, they can't focus. So one simple thing to do is, and again, there's a lot of other examples, but a simple thing would be like, let me schedule and make sure that every 75 minutes, we schedule a break. Get up, stand up, go outside, you know, get off your screen, come back. You know, that's just one. There's like, I could go through 85 different examples. That's a simple example of just one thing you can do. And what great leaders do is they design environments, right, with intention. I say they lead by design. Poor leaders lead by default. They just, oh, we have a 3-hour meeting, let's just go ahead and do it. You've got to realize every single thing is making an impact. Now, is it the impact you want to? And that comes back to, you know, you talked about emotional intelligence, and the first piece of that is self-awareness. The next piece is relationship awareness. What's the impact I'm having on other people? So we've talked about safety, we've talked about energy. The third thing has to do, if you want to create an environment where people are engaged, where they want to stay, loyalty, is you have to give people ownership over the work. I mean, I like to use the analogy of, if you've ever rented a car versus owning a car, like when people don't treat the rental car in the same way, you know, like for me, like if I go to an airport and I have to return a rental car, there's speed bumps. Well, you know, I don't worry about going too fast over a speed bump in a rental car, because if the tire gets a little bit out of alignment, it's not my problem, it's somebody else's problem. I don't treat it with the same care. And so when it comes to ownership, it's really important that we give our people clarity on what they need to do, but we need to give them some freedom on how they do it, right? No one wants their boss to come in and micromanage every single step of the process, because you feel like a robot. Again, you feel like you're controlling. And if you don't remember, just remember what it was like to be a teenager with parents who did that. Teenagers rebel. Like, they're like, I can't deal with this. At some point, like, enough, you can't control every aspect of my life. And so the third piece has to do with creating a sense of ownership. And then the fourth piece, which is super important, has to do with helping people connect to a sense of purpose, that what we do matters, that, you know, we are not just working at a bank, for example. What we're doing is we're facilitating the financial dreams of our customers, right? And so finding whatever, every single business has a higher purpose, and it isn't just to make a return on stock. Like, when you tell me, like, our mission is to increase stockholder return, I want to look for a new job. Like, that doesn't motivate me at all. Whereas you said, hey, what we do, There's no why. Like, let's say I work for a pharmaceutical company. Because our mission is to increase the return of pharmaceuticals, as opposed to, no, what we're doing is we're working to kind of help save people's lives. Like, yeah, that gets me out of bed every day. You know, that'll get me out of bed every day, for sure. And the thing is, what leaders need to do is they have to remember that that purpose needs to be reminded and embedded in our day-to-day. And maybe not every single minute of every single day, but fairly frequently, you need to remind people of why we're doing what we're doing. I like to say, the equivalent of just doing it once, like during an onboarding orientation, it's a little bit like saying, you know, like on my wedding day, if I told my wife we got married 20 years ago, like I said, I love you on our wedding day, nothing's changed. Like, I don't need to say it again, do I? Like, nothing, just assume it's the, no, I need to tell her that every day, because people need to be reminded of the, like you said, the why. And so again, these four things for loyalty have to do with safety, with energy, with ownership, and with purpose.
I mean, that's an interesting breakdown, and therein lies my next question, which is this what you call the facilitative mindset?
This is a big, yeah, so the facilitative mindset, and let me just back up for a second on this. So this book that I wrote, right, Cracking Leadership Code, people say, like, how long did it take you to write the book? And I say, like, not really joking, it took me 25 years in that the book, it wasn't that I didn't just sit down and write, the book came, it emerged out of me working with literally thousands and thousands of groups of leaders and seeing the patterns of what the best leaders were doing well, what the bad leaders were doing poorly, and what I was looking for, what are the overarching common themes, right? And how can I distill these things? So the book reads very easily. It's very simple to read, but it is the distillation of all of this stuff. So the facilitative mindset, what I found is, you know, our world is very complex. I'm sure you're familiar with the acronym VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. Yeah. I mean, we live in such a world of all of that going on. And what people are looking for now, they're not looking for leaders who have all the answers, because no one has all the answers. They're not looking for leaders who can tell them exactly what to do, because no one can tell you exactly what to do. But what they're looking for is, in the midst of the speed and in the midst of the complexity, they're looking for someone who can make things easier. Not easy, but easier. And the word facilitate comes from the Latin word facile. A facilitator makes things easier for you. And so what leaders have to realize is we have to shift. What I call now the facilitative mindset is about getting away from being that old school, I call it the commander in chief, and moving to this new school facilitator in chief. I mean, the fact is, with technology, everyone has access to information. We don't need more information. What we need is insight. And so what we need to do is move information from where it is to where it needs to be, to the right person at the right time in the right place, so they can take the appropriate action to make the right decisions to get the right results. That is way more complex than it was 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. I mean, our world has changed radically, and so we need these facilitators in chief. And the other piece around this is that employees, I mean, people in general have way more options than they ever did. Like we said before, have access to LinkedIn, to Glassdoor, to Indeed. People can find jobs. They know where the grass is greenest, and they're going to find it. And so what you want to do is make your workplace so appealing that no one would even think about entertaining another offer, because why would I ever want to leave? This is the best place I've ever found. And and the expectations keep going up and up and up. And frankly, everything around coronavirus pandemic has made people's expectations go up and up and up even more so, because people are literally questioning, is this worth my life energy? Because all of us literally had to look life and death in the face every single day. It's like, if I go outside and I get sick, there was no vaccine, I could die. Same thing everybody else. And so that changes the value equation considerably, and that leaders and organizations have to understand that and actually embrace the new, I won't call it normal, the new next phase, because the people that do, and the people that lean into being exceptionally human, the people who lean into connection, communication, and collaboration, are the ones who are going to have this competitive advantage moving forward throughout the rest of 2022 and beyond.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, especially with COVID, right? What happened was, we literally just said, look, especially if you have family or you have people, you know, who look up to you or you're looking up to them, people like, I mean, having to, and that has also translated into remote work, right? People now have options. I mean, if you're not going to let me work from home, I didn't just drive or get stuck in traffic, especially for someone like you who lives in New York City, right? I don't want to have to drive or get stuck, and I hear the traffic in New York, just like Lagos as well. The traffic can be hellish. I mean, sometimes when I used to do full-time, days I would leave home 5:30 in the morning and get to the office, catch a nap before work starts. People don't want to do that anymore. They want to be able to have options, in the sense that I want to be able to work from home. Even if I'm going to come to, you know, do some sort of hybrid, it has to be worth it. I need to know that my manager has my back, my company has my back. If I have any issues, I can easily walk up to my manager and my leader to say, look, I have an issue, I'd like to take a few days off. Please, thank you, please and thank you, right? So just like you said, people want a safe place to work. They want to be able to, life is already hard as it is, right? You can't make all my problems anyway, but you can give me an environment to be comfortable in, and to be able to know that I have people, not just, I have people at work, not just at home, that have my back, so to say. Awesome. I'm going to, you know, end, you know, just drive towards the end with this. Your book, right? At what point did you say, I mean, during your whole 20, 25 years experience, you say, look, and I think there has to be a book, you know, somewhere that people can also learn all the stuff that you've learned over the years and all the stuff that you've experienced teaching and speaking and meeting people along the line, facilitating groups as well. At what point did you say, look, and I think it's time for me to write this book, to put it out there?
Yeah, so interesting. That's a great question. And, you know, I'd love to kind of give you the answer that is like, well, I decided this and then I sat down and wrote it. Like, that sounds like it was that. And I'm actually going to share the honest, messy truth. And here's the messy truth, is that I've been wanting to write. I mean, I've been interested in writing a book probably for 20 years. And at one point, I think in 2002, I sat down and I wrote out something like 70,000 words, which is basically the, and it was kind of a random piece of, I mean, if I look back at it, it's not very good. And it, nothing ever happened to that, right? It went to it. I mean, it was a useful exercise to go through. And then I kind of sat on it. And then I was like, but I wanted to keep, I kept feeling like, and I was out every week working with clients and going like, I want to get this out there. I want to get this out there. But I didn't know how to, like, it was almost like writing a book felt too large, right? It's almost like if you think about, I want to start running and saying like, I want to run a marathon. You don't start by going from your couch to running 26 miles, right? You just don't, it's too overwhelming. So you probably won't even get off the couch. It's too big. Yeah, and a book felt kind of overwhelming in the same way. And so I had a friend, he's actually a coach. And he said, Alain, can I give you a little tip on this? He said, writers write. That was his tip. Writers write. And you have to exercise the muscle. He said, a book is daunting. A book is big. He said, do you think you could commit to writing 300 words a week? Like, of course I could do that. He said, great. Why don't you start a blog? Start blogging 300 words. Do one piece, 300 words a week, and commit yourself to doing that. So that's what I started in 2011. I started and I committed to doing one post a week. And they're still on my website, by the way. You can go back to the early posts.
Yeah, I've seen them.
They're not very good. Some of the early ones. And the thing is, the way to get good work is to do a lot of work. I mean, this is true in every creative endeavor. Like, if you want to do good writing, you have to do a lot of writing, because some of it's not going to be very good, but some of it's going to be better. And so I started blogging every week in 2011. By the 2015, I hadn't missed a week. I had over 350 blog posts at this point.
Wow.
And so what I ended up doing is I went back and I reviewed all the blog posts. I looked for a couple things. Number one, what was some of the best writing, which included the best stories that brought things to life. The other thing I looked for were, what were some common themes that kept showing up? Because, you know, every story has a theme, a principle going on. And what I found was, in all of these 350 blog posts, there were three common themes that kept popping out of lots of things: connection, communication, and collaboration. So that became the architecture for the book. And some of the book is actually, a lot of those blog posts, those stories, were repurposed. So for example, the story about the post office, which begins chapter one of the introduction the book, was a blog post, right? So I ended up repurposing things, and it just made the whole lift of writing much easier. So that's the story. It's not pretty, it's not neat and tidy, but it's the truth.
Yeah, I mean, I usually like to, like, you know, ask authors to say, look, it's not like you just, you know, you woke up one day and said, look, I want to write, right? There has to be some, well, even if it's an eureka moment, it has to be some sort of process that you've gone through. I mean, had some experience and you feel, you know, people tend to learn, because I mean, not every author makes money, right? and it's not people just don't write because they don't want to. I mean, I'm not sure, you know, being an author is the fastest way to becoming a millionaire, right? So so you need to be able to, you know, especially for people who are looking to write as well and are listening to the podcast, I want people to be able to say, look, there's a thought process behind it. It's never rosy, it's messy, just like you said. You probably, you know, chunked your first 1,000 words, or you sent to the publisher, and your publisher said, look, this is not going to cut it. You have to go back to the writing table, and you have to keep writing. You know, finally, I'm going to ask you, you know, for people, you know, for aspiring leaders, for people at that pinnacle of their career that they want to lead, what's your word to them? What's your advice to them?
If you want to lead, start leading today. Don't wait till tomorrow. The fact is, you don't need to have a formal title and position at work to lead. I'm going to say we lead as friends. Like if you have a parent, you have a child, you have a friend, every single day you wake up, there is a blank canvas on which you get to paint your leadership. And the three things I would invite you to consider every single day as you paint that canvas is, what am I doing to connect today? What kind of connections and relationships am I building? Do people feel better after having spent time with me, or do they feel the same? Hopefully not worse, but even if they just feel so what am I doing to enrich people in every interaction? So that's connection. Communication, what am I doing to make sure that I'm leading by listening? Right, so start doing these things. Say collaboration. What am I doing to create safety and energy and ownership and purpose for the people around me?
Yeah.
You start doing that, you will become the leader that you want to be. It isn't about getting the promotion and the title and getting the business card that has your name, senior vice president. It's about start leading now. And I will tell you, if you do all those things intentionally, the results and the titles and whatever rewards that come with it will follow. But, you know, act as if you are already leading, because the fact is, you are.
Thank you very much, man. It's been a pleasure. It's been an honor speaking to you on this episode. I've literally learned a million and one things just listening to you over the past 40 minutes. So guys, if you want to, you know, pick up Alan's book, it's available on Amazon, it's available on Barnes & Noble, and it's also available now on Money in the Bank as well. So Alan, if people want to say, look, I need a coach like Alan, how do people reach you?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I do individual coaching, team coaching. I do training work, speaking, like lots of things. Go to my website, easiest place to go, which is www.alainhunkins.com. I'll spell that out for you. It's www.alainhunkins.com. I have various programs I run. I run a 30-day leadership challenge about 3 times a year. So there'll be information all about that on the website. And do feel free, you can contact me through the website, and you can connect with me on LinkedIn as well. And if you do get in touch with me, I'll make sure I get back in touch with you. So thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Alan. I'm going to put that in the episode notes as well, so that people can reach you on the website as well.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much. It's been amazing talking to you. I'm looking forward to chat further on some other collaborations.
Looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Ife. It's been my pleasure.
Cheers. Do enjoy the rest of your day.